You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with the Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm delighted to welcome Carla Fox back to the show. Carla has spent many years as a shamanic practitioner in the Peruvian traditions. In March 2012, she discovered a new protocol through the Monroe Institute, which she calls Quantum Sphere Healing. It has become the main healing modality that she uses with her clients. Carla's focus of service has shifted into the quantum realms, higher dimensions, and alternate realities where much more can be seen, known, and worked with during a healing session. In addition to offering quantum sphere healing sessions, she also gives workshops where anyone can learn how to use this new healing protocol. You can find Carla on her website at www.quantumstargate.com and her blog at www.thecarlafoxblog.blogspot.com and on Facebook. Oh, she knows you're not on Facebook. I'm sorry.
No.
Yeah, that's right. So let's welcome Carla back to the show now. Hi, Carla. How are you?
Oh, great, Lance. It's a delight to be back with you, and I'm so glad that the BBS station is up and running after their calamity there with the fire.
Yes.
In our paradise, yes.
Yeah, that must have been quite a horrifying experience to lose everything in the fire.
Yeah, I've got a couple of friends who lost everything.
Yes, and Marcia Ring and Ralph and Marcia Ring also lost everything.
Yeah.
So it's and you know there are a lot of conspiracy blogs and videos about it.
Okay.
One can always find other alternative reasons for the fires.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, they happened, and Don and Doug bounced back just like the phoenix from the ashes.
Great. Yeah.
Well, now, I remember in our last show, it was a wonderful show, by the way. That was possibly one of our best shows. Well,
oh,
I like
good.
All our shows.
Oh, good.
But towards the end, you mentioned that you were going to be going to Egypt, I believe.
No, Turkey and Lebanon.
Oh, Turkey and Lebanon, sorry. Okay, Turkey
yeah.
and Lebanon, which is just as interesting, if not more so.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and I said, well, you've got to come back and talk about your trip because you see from such a different perspective, having so much background in the quantum fields, that I know that you'll have some interesting stories. So I don't want to take up any more time blah, 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 blahing when
okay.
you could be, you know, sharing whatever it is that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, it was a 2.5-week trip. You know, with my background and what I do, I'm reading energy all the time. And I especially like to put my hands on stone to
oh,
get
yeah.
messages.
Yes.
And certainly, my gosh, I sure got a lot of them on this trip.
Wow.
So, oh, yeah, yeah. And interestingly enough, just for some reason, I checked the U.S. Recommended list of countries not to go to
oh,
right
yeah.
now. And Turkey and Lebanon are both on the list.
Oh.
Did you find any
reason why they shouldn't be visited?
I think because of the Syrian business right
oh,
now.
Okay.
When I went, Turkey was okay. Lebanon was on the list, but only for single travelers.
Oh.
And in particular, single women. Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah,
they,
well.
They've upped that because there's some stuff going on the border there. So let me dive in here. The company that ran the trip is the Megalithomania people out of
oh,
the
yeah.
UK.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we had Hugh Newman and Andrew Collins.
Wow.
And, yeah, the big guns. And, of course, Andrew has written several books featuring Göbekli Tepe.
Yes,
he's the guy in the know. And the title of the trip was The Origins of Civilization. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, we certainly, you know, we were looking at stuff that was 12,000 years old at the oldest. And I was thinking about that. I don't know if I can say it's the oldest on the planet, because I do believe that at the end of the last ice age, there were a lot of civilizations around the coastlines,
mm-hmm.
All around, you know, around all the continents that got flooded.
Mm-hmm.
So we would say, they say Göbekli Tepe is the oldest temple on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the oldest one that's above ground and exposed.
Right, right.
Yeah. And we had 13 people for Turkey, 23 for Turkey, 13 from Lebanon, mostly from England, a few from the U.S., a few from Canada.
Huh.
Yeah, but I want to start off by saying if people want to see the photos, I did extensive posting on my blog of this trip. I'll be talking about some of the sites I did not mention.
Okay.
Tonight, yeah, but there you get the best of my photos.
Are they posted now?
I started posting as soon as I got back. That was the end of October.
Oh, good. So if somebody wanted to go to your blog,
yes,
they could kind of, fill in.
Yeah, scroll backwards. And, in fact, that first post was kind of a summary of, the weather and the places we went, just kind of bits and pieces of things. I have to say the weather was not the best because we were getting, it's getting into the fall season for them there. And so we had some heavy rains. We hit a pretty decent sandstorm. They said it was blowing in from Syria and Iraq.
Oh, geez. Of course.
And I'm thinking, okay, we're breathing this stuff in. That was at Cappadocia where they have all the underground cities and the beehive volcanic tuff formations where they carved into them and they were living in there.
Wow.
And you can take a hot air balloon ride there, and the balloons couldn't go up very high because as soon as they got up to a certain height, they were in the smog, so to speak. And some pretty big rainstorms here and there. That was the only drawback. But the focus was, of course, on megalithic sites, the older the better. And of course, in that area, you've got a lot of newer stuff, Muslim stuff, Romans, all of that. And we weren't looking at any of that. We were looking at the very oldest stuff we could, encounter.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we started in Ankara, didn't do Istanbul. Some of the people on the trip went to Istanbul a couple days ahead to see some of the stuff. And apparently, Troy is the hot item in Turkey for people to visit. Now, you have to do that out of Istanbul. That was not included in our trip. But a lot of people went there first. So let me just give you a little bit of rundown of some of this.
Okay.
We started out in the area around Ankara, which is right in the middle of Turkey, and stayed in a few different places. I think we had 8 different hotels total, but that included Lebanon also.
Okay.
So right off the bat, and some of this, again, I've got the pictures on my blog so people can look at that. Alasha Hoyuk, interesting site. Polygonal walls, just like you see in Peru.
Wow.
Yes, and a bit like in Egypt. I'm convinced a lot of these sites, at least the oldest parts, go back at least 10 to 12,000 years.
Right. It seems pretty easy to go back that far.
It was, and you have to wonder, were they communicating with each other? Were they traveling back and forth?
Certainly
there was a big seafaring society. People went by ocean all over the place. So this site was interesting because they had a Sphinx gate there, 2 megaliths carved with sphinxes on them that you walk between to get into the site.
Huh.
And that's 100% Egypt right there.
Yeah, right.
And then the polygonal wall. And then as you walked around, you could see where they had kind of repurposed the megalithic huge stones and kind of merged them in with the newer parts of the construction, which were cruder, smaller stones.
Yes.
Nowhere did we see any mortar anywhere. Everything was finally fitted as best as they could do it. Yeah. So we spent a couple hours there. I have a picture on my blog of a couple of stones with slots cut into them and very finely cut curved bases on the stones, and yet the common construction of the site were just chunkier that you could pick up, you know, just one guy with his hands,
mm-hmm.
not 10 guys trying to move something that weighed a ton.
Mm.
So it was a mixed site, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But later that afternoon, we went to Hattusa. Now, that is a Hittite, was the Hittite capital, and encompassed several hillsides with the remains of a huge wall around it. And I've got a picture on the blog of they reconstructed a section of the wall, stone on the bottom, and the rest of it was stucco that went up about three stories. So
wow.
This thing was, and the Hittites, that was 1800 to 1200 BC. And again, interestingly carved stones. The stone there was basalt, because the central part of Turkey is all volcanic.
Mm.
But we have the mysterious green stone of Hattusa, and there's a picture of it on my blog. Everything else is like a charcoal gray with interesting flat surfaces, curved surfaces, and then you get to this green stone. It's in the jade family. They don't know where it came from. And, of course, there's no roofs on anything, so you're looking at foundations, you know, and walls, parts of walls. And it's maybe 3 feet by 3 feet and maybe 3 feet tall, 3.5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
As green can be, shiny on the top, probably from people putting their hands on it.
Mm.
And nothing else like that anywhere, and nothing like that in the area. They did not dig that up in that area.
Huh.
So I put my hands on it, and my gosh, I went out into outer space right away.
Wow. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think they were using that for shamanic traveling.
Sure, of course.
Praying. Yeah. So that was really interesting, but my gosh, I would have liked to have a chunk of that stone. It was
I'll bet.
Gorgeous. And then I mentioned Cappadocia. We went into two of the underground cities. And since it's volcanic tuff, very easy to carve out. The one city went down 8 stories into the ground.
Wow.
And so there must have been a reason for them to need that kind of a protection.
Mm-hmm.
They had big round disc-like stones that they could, in slots in the wall, that they could roll out to block the doorways.
Yes.
You know, so something was going on there.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting, but again, we had that dust storm going on, and the photos weren't the best, but just very interesting. All right, then out into the countryside. Now, there's a term called a hoyuk, which means an occupational mound, and that's what we saw in that area. So at the end of the last ice age, that was all swampy there, and there were areas where the ground was a little bit higher. So this is during the hunter-gatherers, and they would build their towns on the little higher spots, and the game and the fowl and the plants were very prolific there because it was wet. So they just had to go out and hunt and gather whatever they needed. Well, that area gradually dried up, and that's when they turned to agriculture.
Ah.
But so you're driving out in the countryside, and every once in a while you see a little hill, you know, and perfectly flat, and here's a little hill, there's a little hill. Most of these are not excavated.
Huh.
And what they would do was when they wanted to build something new, they would collapse the upper half of the building into the center, pound it down, and build on top of it. Yeah, after thousands of years, you've got these hills, and so when they excavate, and we visited several, you're looking down into this pit.
Oh.
Yeah, because, so you climb up to the top, and then with the excavation, it goes down, 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 down. In one location, they had it sandbagged and propped up because they were afraid the whole thing would cave in on the people who were excavating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking about big holes here.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And that was Çatalhöyük, very famous. They say it's the world's first city. 7500 B.C. to 5700 B.C. But there was also another interesting spot. You know, some of these, we were the only people there, and others, there were a lot of other tourists. There was one site called the Şiklihöyük, where they dug down to the original foundation of a building that was 10,000 years old.
Oh.
Yeah, and you could see the stucco on the walls and the finely polished floor. But the interesting thing there was, and of course we climbed up the hill and then looked down into it, there were obsidian flakes all over the ground there.
Oh.
Because it was volcanic, that's what they were making their arrowheads out of.
Oh, yes, right, right.
All over the place, and some pretty big chunks, too, after 10,000 years.
Nice.
You know, as the dirt washes away, that stuff kind of pops out, you know, pops up to the surface. All right, Göbekli Tepe. So this is the... I had read Andrew's book, I'm thinking, 4 years ago already, and... As soon as the opportunity came about, I signed up for a trip, but they canceled that trip twice in that year, and that was 2016, I'm thinking. That's when a lot of the refugees were coming, Syrian refugees were coming through the countryside.
Okay.
Plus they built a roof on top of Göbekli Tepe and didn't let the tourists go in there, so for a variety of reasons. And so this trip was the first one that showed up that I had the opportunity to go on. So they call Göbekli Tepe the oldest place of worship in the world. Well, certainly the oldest one that's been dug up.
Right. There may be older ones.
There may be older ones, and, sure. You know, a lot of those sites in Egypt, I'm sure, you know, they would never say they go back that far, but I'm sure they do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like the Osirian and the Valley Temple and places like that. I'm sure they are that old. But they liken Göbekli Tepe to a place of worship.
Mm-hmm.
So it was built and used between 9800 B.C. and 8600 B.C., it was a hunter-gatherer society, and yet it's so sophisticated and so unusual. They started building it, you know, the Ice Age started, the ice started melting, and then we got hit by something, and I don't know if it was a comet, ejection from the sun, solar radiation, cosmic rays, whatever, that threw us into the Younger Dryas, which was like a mini ice age.
Mm-hmm.
So we got colder for about 12 to 1500 years before it started to warm up again. And that's when Göbekli Tepe was built, during that mini ice age. And they show you go there. You go through a little museum film thing before you go out to the site. And they show guys in like cavemen in loincloths and furs dragging stones across the ground.
Wow. Do you think they really did that?
I don't think so.
I don't know how.
The tallest T-shaped pillar at Göbekli Tepe is 18 feet tall, and I forget how many tons it weighs, and it's got animals carved all over it.
Oh, good Lord.
I don't... You know, so I just had a laugh. It just looked kind of comical to me. You know,
right.
cavemen in furs dragging these huge stones across the ground.
20 tons.
So the what they call the enclosures are circular. It was kind of a shock to me because I thought they were spread out more, but they're one right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Enclosures with these tall T-shaped pillars. Enclosure D, again, Oh, I do have it written down here. 18 feet tall, two pillars, 15 to 20 tons each.
Mm.
And they're very thin.
Mm-hmm.
They've got them propped up with wooden posts.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're barely sitting on the ground. They're sitting in grooves. So they're very tall and thin.
Well, I typed in Göbekli Tepe, Göbekli
okay.
Tepe, and I got a, and then clicked on images, mm-hmm. and so there are all images of the Göbekli Tepe.
Yes.
And one of them looks like a frying pan with two pillars in the center.
Yes, that's what they look like.
Those are the enclosures, yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
fascinating.
Yeah, and they each one has what they call a either a spirit hole or a soul hole.
Mm.
A hole, and they can tell that when each enclosure was built, and a little different time frame for each, the hole pointed right to the constellation Cygnus, the Swan, and the star Deneb.
Okay.
And so the newer ones were tilted a little more at a different angle. And so this is a society that, you know, cultures around the world felt that when the soul left the body, they would enter the great rift of the Milky Way. It's like a black crack in the Milky Way.
Hmm.
And at the top of it, where the crack narrows, is the constellation of the Swan and the star Deneb. And so that is like the exit point for this reality.
Wow.
Not everyone made it up there. But one of the purposes of, you know, I feel, Göbekli Tepe, was to assist the spirits of the dead to get to where they needed to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that very interesting because that's one of the things I do when I do death rites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
And at the time of that construction, Deneb was our North Star.
Oh, I did not know.
Yes. So that's another way they're dating those enclosures, is how, you know, okay, how where were they aimed, and what would have been there in the sky at that point, and then they can track with a computer program, okay, what was the year that Deneb was straight on through that mm-hmm. spirit hole up in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a society that was very focused on the stars and the Milky Way. Once they turned to agriculture, that's when they stopped using Göbekli Tepe, because then it was solstice and equinox.
Mm.
Not the position of the stars, per
mm-hmm.
se.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it was the same deal with Göbekli Tepe. They gradually filled it in. You know, the theory that I had read before we got there was that something happened and they just all of a sudden filled the whole thing in and abandoned it. But that's not true, because the traditional way of decommissioning these sites is just to pile dirt on them. You know,
okay.
Or like the Hoyoks, the little villages, and build on top of it or just abandon it and go somewhere else, which they certainly did there, yeah.
Huh.
So the night before we got to Göbekli Tepe, I was being downloaded with all this information and traveling through the portal at Deneb. I'm convinced it leads into a different universe.
Ah.
Because the symbology is so unusual there at Göbekli Tepe. There are other sites they call sister sites of Göbekli Tepe in the area, but we visited one of them. We went out into the country and visited some goat farmers, and they had a site on their property, but their T-shaped stones were only 4 feet high.
Mm.
Little tiny versions of Göbekli Tepe.
Huh.
And they said they, over the years, had been having trouble with the locals trespassing at night and stealing whatever they could, you know, whatever was movable off of that
right.
site. Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah. So my sense, you know, what I got when I tracked that, and unfortunately I could not put my hands on any of the stones that
are
there, because I'll tell you why in a minute.
Okay.
But I do believe advanced spiritual knowledge came to us through that portal
mm-hmm.
of the Cygnus constellation. And Göbekli Tepe was built to create an exit point out of this creation, and in case we had another big cataclysm like we did that ended the Ice Age.
Mm.
Yeah.
I see in one of these pictures that apparently at that site there is the Tower of Babel, and it's connected in some way to Planet X, according to this particular picture.
Oh, okay.
So, and it does look like the Tower of Babel.
Yeah.
So I don't know where it would be, but it looks like there's a lot of ruins that cover a great area.
Yes, and they have they're still excavating at Göbekli Tepe.
Wow.
I mean, they dug up the main temples there, but there's stuff all over the place, and in that area. So clearly, it was more fertile and wetter, and enough game for the hunter-gatherers at that point. So that's what I got in a download the night before.
Oh.
The traditional bird for Cygnus is the swan.
Okay.
But if you're looking at the pictures of Göbekli Tepe, they use a vulture.
Oh. Well, yes. I'm looking at the pictures that I think are just beautiful, and it says November 9th, 2018, it says Cattleyoak.
Cattleyoak, yes.
That's it,
yes.
Yeah. And they're red, and they're
yes.
more with the different animals, and they're quite interesting.
Gorgeous.
Yes.
What they did was, while they were excavating, they made note of the artwork on the wall. And, of course, that's the whole cosmology. You've got vultures there, too, as you can see. You've got men with,
no
leopard
heads.
Skins. Leopard skins, which
yeah,
was there.
That's
like
right.
Pomp. Yeah, another animal to take you over to, to the world beyond.
Mm-hmm.
The auroch, which was the cattle at the time.
Yeah.
And so what they did was they recreated what the insides of their little houses would have looked like and painted that on the walls.
Oh, they're just beautiful.
They're gorgeous. And you cannot see them, the excavations. And I'm sure the pigments, if you actually were able to see something on the wall looking down into that particular pit, the colors wouldn't be as bright. So, that was a recreation of their dwellings and the paintings. Yeah. But the vulture, so a lot of cultures use the swan to take you to the next realm.
Well, I like that one.
And this culture used a vulture.
Okay.
And I actually kind of experienced myself turning into a vulture.
Oh, cool.
And, when I was kind of downloading and meditating on Göbekli Tepe and assisting the deceased, the soul of the deceased, which they always depict as either a ball or a human skull next to the vulture.
Hmm.
But I have to say, the pictures of Göbekli Tepe were taken before they put the roof on.
Mm-hmm.
By people who had special permission to go actually down in there, because it's also down in a pit. So, you get the beautiful night sky in the background and perfectly lit so that you can see all these animals carved on all these pillars.
Mm.
And it's absolutely nothing like that when you go there in person.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get close to it. So let me kind of describe what it looks like before I tell you what I experienced just walking up to it.
Okay.
So for years they thought it was a cemetery, an old cemetery, because you could see parts of stone sticking up, and they thought it was headstones. Until someone went and actually started sifting through the little artifacts and the debris and realized there was something else there. Klaus Schmidt, who's the German archaeologist who spearheaded that project, unfortunately died several years ago, but he wrote an excellent book, and that was his career, was digging that up. So they bus you up to a little visitor center. You look at some films and some other things going on, and then you take mini buses up to the actual site,
mm-hmm.
and there's a roof on it. but it's like an open air, kind of looks like a clamshell kind of, a twisted clamshell kind of thing. Then they have a chest high chain link fence all the way around where they dug, with a wooden walkway around. And because we were towards winter, they had already winterized it and strung this green, looked like a fiberglass mesh thing, and anchored it to the top of the chain link fence, like a lid. Because of the open air nature of the roof they put on it, stuff can blow in.
Oh, right.
So the only way you could see what was in there was to bend down and look through the chain link fence. It was horrible.
Oh, I can imagine.
And ordinarily, you know, without that green tarp on there, you could lean over the chain link fence and take pictures. And it was a cloudy day. My pictures were just not good at all. So if someone wants to really see what it looks like, go on the internet and you'll see those original pictures that were taken with the nice lighting and the night sky and no roof on it. And they're just gorgeous. Yeah. And so you're looking down into a pit. And it's not completely excavated, but they did enough for all the enclosures to be exposed and all the prominent T-shaped pillars with all the animals on them. And so I was able to, I've got a camera with a little lens that pops out, stick the lens through the chain link fence to get some pictures.
Right.
People were sticking their hands through the fence, getting their smartphones on the other side of the fence, and taking pictures that way.
And
I'm thinking, how many people drop their phones down
and can't get them?
And can't get them. Absolutely not, yes. And so all these T-shaped pillars are propped up, and because they're barely, you know, maybe there's a 6-inch deep groove on the bottom carved out of the bedrock, and this is all limestone. They show pictures where they think all these T-shaped pillars were actually posts holding up a roof.
Certainly
they couldn't stand up on their own. So that's what it looks like. And, of course, a lot of people, but you can hang out there as long as you want. So as I am, so we get up in the little mini buses, get off, and start walking up the wooden walkway up to the site. And I'm feeling like I am walking through quicksand. It's like I'm dragging myself up there and getting into this altered state, this trance-like state, and I'm thinking, whoa, something's going on here. You know, time got altered. Of course, not everyone would experience that, but it was just, it was such a dramatic feeling. Just like I'm in slow motion, you know, going up there. And it turns out that my sense was every circular enclosure was its own vortex or portal. And so you had a bunch of them clustered in one area, and that's where you had the chain link fence around it and the roof above it. And, man, did that pack a punch. Oh, my gosh. And so I just kind of drifted along and just soaked it all in. It was very interesting, and also considering my interest in shamanic death rites, because I know that that's what they were doing there. They had to be, yeah. In what form, I don't know, whether it was for individuals that had died or for the whole society. I think they were traveling back and forth to Deneb and perhaps out in and out of that portal that's up there, that Stargate that's up there.
Sure.
So that was very interesting.
Was there anything in particular that struck you energetically as being, as standing out above the rest?
Well, no other site that we visited had that feeling, first of all. And, you know, they build these, and this is all over the planet, they'll build a site like that on a spot that's already got good energy. So there had to be something going on in that particular place before they built Göbekli Tepe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the structures amplify that. The ceremonies they would do, you know, through the spirit hole and out to Cygnus and back. All different kinds of animals, a lot of foxes, I have to say, and all the foxes on the pillars looked like they were leaping into the air.
Wow.
Yeah.
Your family.
Yeah, my family. You know, so they had, my sense is they were helping launch the deceased, you know, with the leaping energy.
Right.
And the vultures and the ducks and the cattle, just very detailed. And again, on the internet is probably the best way you can see those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But at the, and we were, the town was San Lierfa, they had a detailed recreation of that particular enclosure, Enclosure D, in the museum. And so you could walk there and look up at the pillars and walk amongst them and touch them and everything. So that was very nice. It's a very nice museum.
Well, that's
good. Yeah, and get some good pictures of the animals that were carved. But we had an incident while we were there, Lance.
What happened?
Well, so our group is kind of dawdling our way around on the you know, looking through the chain link fence and all, taking pictures, and I noticed this tall, skinny guy kind of shadowing us.
He
didn't have a backpack, he didn't have a camera, no water bottle, and I thought, oh, he's security. Well, it turns out he was the head archaeologist for the site.
Oh.
And he knew we were coming. He knew Andrew's reputation, and when Andrew started talking to some other tourists, giving his alternative view of what was going on there, the archaeologist kicked him out of the site.
Really?
He told them to leave and never come back.
Was that because he didn't believe the material that Andrew was sharing?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah.
He wanted to stick to just the archaeology, and none of this cosmology or the alternative stuff. So he kicked
him
out.
Jeez.
Oh, and that was the topic of conversation for the whole rest of the trip. Andrew
I'll
was
bet.
So pissed off. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, all right. So that was towards the end of the trip. Of course, we went up to Mount Nimrut, and it was sleeting. The big deal is to go up there for sunset and the you know, all the statues glow. Well, it was sleeting. It was something else. We had lunch in a lovely restaurant on the Euphrates River. They've dammed up the Euphrates, so it was more like looking out over a lake. But it's their major electrical power plant for the country, the Euphrates. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But Lebanon, So not everyone went on for that part of the trip. I'm glad I did. It was an add-on extra. And Lebanon, what an interesting place. It's a tiny country. You know, we landed in Beirut. There's still bombed-out buildings there from their civil war.
Jeez.
The Holiday Inn, big holes blasting in it, and they never took it down.
Oh.
So... Civil War was 1975 to 1990, and then they just, no city planning, nothing, just built whatever they wanted, wherever, and so it's just stuff all over the place.
Mm.
No plan, no nothing, abandoned buildings right in downtown Beirut, bombed out buildings still, and then, of course, you've got, it's about 50-50 Christian and Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Orthodox, you've got Catholics, you've got Maronites, you've got all your Muslim sects. It's just like chop suey, just very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize that Lebanon was ruled by France. I did not know that. So all the old-timers speak French.
Ah, interesting.
And the younger people speak Arabic. And a lot of the buildings, the signs on the stores and all, you'll have Arabic, you'll have French, you'll have English. It's a little bit of everything. A lot of Syrian refugee camps. We went through one town that started out as a Palestinian refugee camp, and they decided to stay, and they made it into a town, regular buildings.
Mm-hmm.
There was another town there at the end that was Armenian refugees, and they decided to stay. At the very last, we were less than a mile from the border with Syria.
Hmm.
And we were in that situation in Turkey, too, very close to the border. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we, of course, Baalbek was the highlight, but we did go to Byblos, which is on the Mediterranean, and it was your main Phoenician port.
Wow.
So, and there was a big Crusader castle there, too,
oh,
on the property.
Nice.
What had happened was the whole thing had been covered over, and people built these big fancy houses right on the Mediterranean, and they tore them all down and excavated. So
wow.
Again, you're going, yeah, going down deep. They left one house to show people the type of place that was built there and how high up it looked because the earth had filled in so much.
Hmm.
But the town of Byblos, what a cute little place. That was nice. So let's move on to Baalbek. That's the other highlight. And started out, and I've got a picture of this on the blog, at a quarry, and again, this is limestone. They've got one stone that's 1,100 tons. They call it the Stone of the Pregnant Women.
Hmm.
And then in 2014, they found one that's just a little bit below and off to the side. They figured 1,650 tons. And across the road, there's a and these are like, they look like big shoebox size that's, you know, long and narrow. The one across the road is 1,240 tons.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I put my hands on the one they call the Stone of the Pregnant Woman, and what she said was she was never meant to be moved.
Hmm.
At all. Hugh Newman said that he's seen in other quarries where there's, oh, like the unfinished obelisk down in Aswan in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
where they've carved out something that's clearly bigger than anything they've ever moved out of there and left it there half-finished. He said he's seen that in many places. And so, you know, the sense is that that's the stone that's going to birth the rest of the stones, the stone of the pregnant woman.
Oh, right.
But there's a picture on my blog on that, and it is absolutely huge. But while we were there, that was the first day there near Baalbek, this big thunderstorm came up, and it actually snowed in the mountains.
Mm.
You know, we're talking towards the end of October.
Wow.
The next day we're looking, and all the Lebanon has a lot of mountains. We were in the Bekaa Valley. So from Beirut, you go up over a mountain range and down into the valley. They make a lot of wine there. And they were growing a lot of cotton also. But everything was green. You know, a lot of the leaves were turning. And that next day, there's snow all over the tops of the mountains around the valley.
Wow.
So Baalbek. And I'm looking at our time. Make sure we don't run out here. Because this was the other really fabulous thing. It is so huge. Everything in there is huge. They've got red granite pillars that they brought from the quarry in Aswan, Egypt.
Mm.
Meaning they had to float them down the Nile and across the Mediterranean, over to Lebanon, and then over land.
Mm.
It was, and the topic of giants kept coming up, that were there giants back then, especially here at Baalbek? And did the giants help lift the stones and put them in place and help build? And I really think they did.
Mm-hmm.
I just this afternoon read some descriptions of how many men it would have taken with special ropes and pulleys and all to drag some of these stones over the ground. And like 40,000 men for a 1,000-ton stone. But the bulk of Baalbek was built by the Romans, but it was undoubtedly built on top of an older foundation, a megalithic foundation.
Mm.
And so we just wandered and stared.
Mm.
At one point, there was a break, and it's high up. It's very tall. That afternoon, we went around the backside to look at the walls and just really, I mean, five stories up on the backside.
Mm-hmm.
And there are stones in the wall. There's three stones called the Trilithon. Each one is 800 tons. It's unusual because they're put on, placed on top of smaller stones. Generally, you see the bigger ones on the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and then they get smaller as they go up to the top. They were placed on top of smaller stones. And then there was a wall just outside the perimeter. It looked like railroad cars lined up. And clearly, parts of the building were built around them, so I think those were the original stones. And how they got there, I don't know. I put my hands on those, and again, I, you know, as I quite often get, that these stones were vibrationally made lighter and softer, so they could easily be carved and levitated.
Yep, that makes sense to me.
And the message that I got from those big stones was, and this was interesting, they said the weight of the stone doesn't matter when you're trying to move them because they're all the same at that point, which tells me they have a way of lightening up that vibration, you know, vibrationally, so that it doesn't matter how big it is. You know, they can move it all the same way.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, Baalbek, oh, my goodness. Just, I mean, it throws you out of your body right away.
Wow.
Because it's just so huge. Yeah, and then that last bit, we went to another quarry that was in a residential area where the Romans had been cutting limestone blocks and created an underground kind of a cave. Because the limestone on the surface was not good for building. You had to go down maybe 5 feet or so to get to the quality limestone. But the interesting thing was the sun was setting at that point, and there was a sun calendar cave there.
Huh.
On the opposite side of where the Romans were quarrying, very shallow, there was a window off to the side, the sun was shining in there, there were grooves in the back of the cave, and I told Hugh, you know, if they go back, they really should investigate that as a solstice or equinox site.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Because it clearly was to me, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so many of those sites are.
Yes. But you have to be able to recognize them, and you have to be there at that time of day, you know, sunrise, sunset. And he has a contact in that area, a guy that was showing us the quarries that lives there. And I said, get a hold of him and just have him go out and take pictures, sunrise and sunset, equinox and solstice.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll know. So that was a calendar site. Yeah. And then that last day, the only day we had clear blue sky, I had to throw this in. We ate lunch at this huge tourist restaurant, huge, that had indoor gardens. They had a bowling alley.
Oh.
And they had sushi.
Oh, nice.
So Hugh and I split some sushi. It was just, I mean, you just never know. That's Lebanon. You just never know what you're going to find there.
Wow.
Just all kinds of interesting things, but a lot of police checkpoints, a lot of armed guards all over the place. The Syrian refugees were doing day labor, and, of course, a lot of international help for them. They live in these big white tents, flat-topped tents. Just very unusual. I'd go back to Turkey, no problem. Lebanon, I think I've seen what I need to see. It was just very unusual, not very unexpected what was going on there. Yeah. So that was the trip. It took me a couple weeks to recover from that, Lance. It was just 10 hours from Frankfurt to Denver was enough.
Wow.
I think because of all the altered states of energy.
Yeah.
It takes a while to recover from something like that.
Oh, absolutely. And then when you return, of course, you go through the descent into madness.
Business as usual.
Yeah.
So that's kind of it in a tuna can, Lance. Any questions?
Well, let me see. I've been looking through all of the photos as we speak, and there were a couple of things here that I thought were really unusual. I'm going to have to go back now. But
did you see the photo of the green stone?
Yes, yes,
I did. Isn't that fabulous?
Yes, they're like those blocks, right?
Yeah.
And they're worn smooth. I mean, in fact, that was what I wanted to ask you about. And there's a crystal skull, too.
Oh, yeah, that's my skull. I take them when I travel.
Oh, that's yours?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And so he gets energized with the various sights.
Right.
And then I bring him back, and he sits with my collection and transmits that.
Oh, how wonderful.
In fact, on the way back over from the Becca Valley to Beirut, we went over a mountain, kind of a mountainous area, and stopped at a place where they had a huge sodalite pillar right out by the road, and I'm talking like 8 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out it was this fabulous rock shop run by these people from Brazil.
Wow.
In Lebanon. So I bought two more skulls in there.
Oh,
you know,
good.
I'm always looking, and we just had enough time to run in and run out, and I picked up a couple unusual skulls. But who would think? A rock shop run by Brazilians in Lebanon.
Wow, that was a find.
Yeah, that's the kind of unexpected stuff you find there. Very
unusual. Oh, that's wonderful.
Place.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by the crystal skulls.
Mm-hmm.
But these green objects, they seem to be, they would be in alignment with the spiritual aspect, especially if they were considered a place where people would, communicate with their source and, rub their hands around and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it kind of reminds me of the, what is that large cube that's in the center of one of the towns? That Mecca, is it Mecca?
Oh, yes, yeah, in Mecca, yeah. That black, that big black,
yeah.
I know it's got a name, I can't think of it right now. Yeah.
And then there's a small exposed stone, which is smooth, and that supposedly is where you, communicate.
Okay.
And I've always had the impression that that was a technological device.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about how many people are drawn there and what they,
right.
the energy that they're pouring into that.
Yes.
It just seems, and it's covered, so you can't see it.
Right.
It just seems there's more to it than meets the eye.
Well, and I think if we can also adjust our view of what is technology, if we can look at technology without electricity.
Yes.
Or without
yes.
some kind of a power source.
Yes.
That can be technology, too, and that's what the ancients used. I'm sure they did.
Yes, and of course that could bring up the whole subject of 5G and a PG&E bank being bankrupt. And it would be the perfect storm for a new energy that is not harmful to the people or to the surrounding area to be brought out.
And that's why I like visiting those sites, the old sites, because I know they use something different.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know that we humans, it's in our DNA. Maybe it's dormant.
Right.
But I know we've inherited that information somehow.
It's all in us.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything missing.
It's just,
maybe a few brain cells. But
yeah. I hope there's nothing missing, Lance. but that's why I like going to those places, putting my hands on those stones and getting that information.
Yes. Oh, that was such a wonderful opportunity.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, do you have any plans for another trip in the near future?
I actually just booked a trip to Iceland, but
good.
That's hiking.
Yeah.
But again, it's very volcanic. I love that energy of the lava.
Oh, yeah.
And the hot springs and the steam and the, I think lava holds a fabulous kind of a raw transformative energy.
Oh, yeah.
I love. Yeah, so I'll be hiking around. That's in July.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that'll be another opportunity for us to talk.
Yeah, and more pictures.
Yes. Well, many people don't realize that you're a professional, really a professional photographer.
Oh, thank you, Lance.
You know, yeah. And when I got those beautiful cards from you that had your pictures on the front of them, I was absolutely amazed at the quality of them. They were so finely done, and they were just basically perfect. They looked like picture postcards that you might get at a very high-class, highbrow store. Your pictures are worth seeing.
Well, so people should go look at the blog, and I encourage everyone to sign up to receive my posts when I post them.
Yes.
Because, you know, I'll do a mass email every once in a while, but the blog is the place to go to.
Oh, yeah.
To see the pictures and for notifications.
Well, I post your blog on Facebook because it's one of my favorites.
Oh,
and,
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there are not many left that I really get as much out of, but yours is one, and of course, there are a couple of others. Occasionally, a mutual friend writes one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And yes.
Timothy Glenn.
Yes.
And those are always a must read.
Yeah.
Yours I read right away and post because there's always something rich and fulfilling to get out of it, even if it seems to be. It's just a travel blog or something simple.
Yeah.
You infuse it with something special, and I don't know how you do that, but it's just you.
I guess so. Well, it's been busy since I got back from Lebanon, and I'm hoping to post a little bit more often now. In fact, we have a launching tomorrow.
Oh, nice!
So maybe I'll have some good information to put on the blog about that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I will be checking for it.
Yeah.
Well, Carla, I think we're at the end of the show, and we have to sign off. And do you want to mention your blog site or website again?
If they go to quantumstargate.com, best way to get on the blog is the upper left corner. You can there's a button there.
Wonderful.
And I've added two new CDs onto my product page. One is Catnapper.
Oh.
It's Robert Monroe's voice leading you through a half-hour meditation where he takes you down deep and brings you back up. And it's a great way to get over jet lag or not having a good night's sleep.
Oh, nice.
And it's his voice. It's fabulous.
Oh, I've got to get that.
Yeah, and then I put on there Shamanic Journey Rattle, easy way to get into Theta. The HemiSync does that too, but you need headphones for HemiSync.
Yeah.
For the Shamanic Journey Rattle, you can just play it in the room and the Theta. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I love the HemiSync tapes, too.
Yeah. So that's the new stuff. I'm not teaching any workshops this year, but I am starting my training in remote viewing. So that's the other big deal going on here.
Oh, that should be a wonderful class.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Carla, thank you so much for coming back and sharing your tales, your tall tales with us.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. And I will talk to you again in the very near future.
Okay, sounds good, Lance. I appreciate you having me on again.
Oh, I love having you on. So you're always fun to talk to.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
All right.
Good
night,
Carla.
Evening. Goodbye.
Good night, everybody.